You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, SFU's community radio station broadcasting live from Burnaby, BC.
The most important thing about September 11th, 2001 is the fact that it sensitizes us as a nation to the pain and suffering that other countries have gone through, may go through in the future, some of which is attributable or supported by, has been in the past, by U.S. policies. And the degree to which we have felt that as a nation, I think, is important and will give us energy to reflect and try and work harder on our own foreign policies abroad, so that there are no future September 11ths in Chile or in the United States. And I think that's the link between the two of them.
That's Peter Kornbluh, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan.
Welcome to this special AR archival program marking the 50th anniversary of the U.S. coup d'etat in Chile.
On the other September 11th, 1973. September 11th is now engraved on the consciousness of Americans. Yet for the South American country of Chile, the date has a different and much more tragic significance. It was on that day in 1973 that the democratically elected government of Salvador Allende was overthrown in a CIA-backed military coup. Augusto Pinochet seized power. In the ensuing years, tens of thousands of Chileans were killed, jailed, tortured, and driven into exile. The U.S. role, under Nixon and his national security advisor Kissinger, in first destabilizing and then overthrowing the Allende government, was decisive. It will rank among the most grotesque interventions ever undertaken by the United States. A few years after the coup, Nobel Peace Prize winner Kissinger visited Chile. He told General Pinochet, "In the United States, as you know, we are sympathetic with what you are trying to do here." Peter Kornbluh is senior analyst with the National Security Archive in Washington, D.C. He's done extensive research on the coup in Chile and its aftermath. He's the author of the book, The Pinochet File. Peter Kornbluh spoke at the annual Talking Together lecture series at the Wellfleet Public Library in Wellfleet, Massachusetts.
Part of what I'm going to be speaking about is the other September 11th. Many in my community think of it as the first September 11th, and that is the date, 1973, of the Chilean coup, Pinochet's takeover in Chile, and the launch of his 17-year dictatorship. For many Chileans, September 11th, 1973, was an act of terrorism, an act of brutal violence, unprecedented in their political history, on their institutions, and on many, many individuals. An act clearly, as we look at the evidence that has come out since, to terrorize large portions of the Chilean community and even eliminate specific sectors of that society. The Chilean coup, of course, had an external component, and that is the support of the United States of America, notably two policymakers, President Richard Nixon and his then National Security Advisor, Henry Kissinger, who then became Secretary of State only days after the coup took place. That support certainly did contribute to the changes that took place, the fateful change of Chilean history in 73 and thereafter. And it certainly, I think, contributed to changing our own history as well. Some have seen a connection between the two September 11s. And that is something that at the end of my talk I'd certainly like to address. But as I start, let me just say that we're gathered here on a week that has been a very good week for Augusto Pinochet, who is back in the news once again. His good news is that he has basically beaten the rap, that he has been ruled too demented to be persecuted, to be prosecuted. Therefore, the case that has been filed against him, which is a very specific case in Chile of a massacre that took place, a kind of a moving massacre that took place in October of 1973, when he sent one of his agents out with a kind of a death squad team in a helicopter with papers that Pinochet had signed saying this team should be allowed to, quote, expedite justice in the northern region of Chile. And every place that this helicopter landed with this military team on it, people were taken out of jail. They were already in jail, waiting to be indicted, waiting to be tried for crime, for the crime of supporting the previously elected government of Salvador Allende. And they were taken out of jail in the middle of the night and shot. The helicopter would then move on to the next province, and the same thing would happen. And this happened five times over the course of 6 days. And in the end, 73 people were dead, and I think 18 of them never were found again. And under a loophole in Chilean law, those 18 disappeared, desaparecidos, created a possibility for the families to file a case against Augusto Pinochet, and that is the specific case that he has now been ruled too mentally ill to face a court of law. So he has essentially escaped justice. And that is, I think, a very sad fact for many, many people, particularly his victims who had hoped to at least have the opportunity to face him in a court of law. But I am here to tell you that, of course, he may have escaped justice, but he certainly cannot escape history. And those who supported him cannot escape history. And indeed, among the many, many significant impacts, results of his arrest, stunning arrest, in October of 1998 in London, where he was vacationing then, was the fact that we were able to use the international attention, international pressure around his arrest to push the Clinton administration to declassify over 24,000 never-before-seen documents that recorded, many of them, almost the day-to-day history of U.S. involvement in Chile, U.S. actions in Chile, the U.S. Policies towards Chile, U.S. support for the coup, endorsement of Pinochet's regime. Many, many documents that recorded evidence of the atrocities of his regime, which in the end become the only evidence on paper that we have and that Chileans have on these atrocities. The last 16,000 of them were released in November of the year 2000. They included all of the CIA records that the agency had tried very hard to withhold from this process, to conceal and to hide. I call these documents the Pinochet file because, of course, they were released with the focus on his arrest and on the pressure to have some accountability, both about his human rights abuses and about what the United States knew and did about those abuses. Some of you won't be too surprised to know that many of the documents that were released look like this. And when the censors who wield this black magic marker in the name of national security got tired of all of this inking, they would release the documents and they would look like this, which is certainly much easier. You're just give a white page out and say the whole page is denied in full. You don't have to bother with selective inking. But on the whole, the documents that were released together tell an extraordinary story of U.S. involvement and knowledge, actions and inaction in Chile. They provide compelling evidence that can be used in Chilean courts and perhaps even in U.S. courts at some point. They really do add up to a dossier of atrocity, which it is my hope will provide historical accountability where legal accountability may no longer be possible. I've spent the last year reading almost every single one of this last release, these 16,000 documents, which include several thousand declassified CIA operational records of U.S. involvement to overthrow the Allende government between 1970 and 1973, and many, many other documents. And there are so many stories that they tell, I couldn't begin in the short time that we have to go over all of them. But I wanted to share some of my findings with you and just simply break down these documents and what they reveal into several different categories. And these categories, in terms of the utility of these documents, are basically four. They allow us to be a fly on the wall in the decision-making process of the U.S. government. And not just one administration or two administrations, but almost all of the administrations that dealt with Allende and Pinochet over a 20-year period. 20 years of history, 20 years of policymaking that at times we can actually sit in the room now with these documents and hear our president, our national security advisor, our secretary of state, and all of the cabinet members, the CIA director, all discussing what to do and how to do it. They allow victims of human rights abuses in Chile to pursue justice and to learn about evidence that the U.S. government had in their cases that in several prominent cases were withheld from these families at the time. One such family is the family of Charles Horman, about whom the movie Missing was made 20 years ago. Another such family is the family of Orlando Letelier, who was killed by a car bomb in Washington, D.C., along with a colleague of his, a 25-year-old New Jersey woman named Ronnie Carpin Moffat, who was a passenger in the car. Their families have learned a great deal about what the United States knew, but didn't tell them 27 years ago when this act of international terrorism took place. They allow us to begin to rewrite the history books, which is what I'm trying to do with my book, The Pinochet File, to basically take these documents and compare them to the memoirs of people like Richard Nixon and Henry Kissinger and others, and to see what the underlying truth is that didn't make it into the public accounts of these retired officials. And finally, and I think for me most importantly, they provide a modicum of history and accountability for Pinochet, for Kissinger, for Nixon, and many, many others. The documents name names. You know who said what, you know who did what, who argued for what policy, who was responsible for what. And I think that is extremely important, particularly when we have a situation where it is unlikely that anybody will be tried legally for policies that did result in true crimes against humanity. Let me just go through very quickly these four categories with examples. I've got a little show and tell here. I brought some of the documents on transparencies. This is a document that, again, gives you this idea of being a fly on the wall in the room. This is the notes of the CIA director at the time, Richard Helms. These were the only known notes when they were declassified, and these documents were declassified some years ago. This document came out some years ago. It's the only extant document recording a president of the United States ordering the overthrow of a democratically elected government. Yes, we have documents on John F. Kennedy talking about CIA efforts to overthrow Fidel Castro. But that was very different from this document, where Salvador Allende had been elected in a three-way race in Chile. Certainly his victory was narrow. He had won by 36,000 votes in Chile. But looking back on our own most recent election, where our current president may have only won, if at all, by 500 votes, we see that 36,000 is nothing to sneeze at. In any event, here you have the President of the United States telling the CIA director that he must save Chile. He can spend $10 million. He should make the economy scream. Use the best men we have. 48 hours, come up with a plan of action, present it to Henry Kissinger. And this is where we start this history, with Richard Nixon deciding that the election of Salvador Allende in Chile was unacceptable to the United States, and ordering the CIA to prevent Allende from actually taking office. Here he had been elected, he had not yet been inaugurated, and the president was telling the CIA to go in there and basically create a climate for a coup, foment domestic upheaval, economic chaos, in order to force the Chilean military to block Allende from even becoming being inaugurated as president. This is a document is dated September 15th, 1970. The inauguration was due to be on November 4th, 1970. And in a 15-minute meeting, you see what orders were given. But let me just share with you a document that did come out in November of 2000. One of the outstanding questions for historians has always been, why? Why did Nixon care so much about not even a communist candidate in Chile, but a socialist candidate in Chile, winning an election there? What were his reasons? And he publicly told a story three times about what it was that compelled him to take this action against Allende. He was interviewed by David Frost at one point in the mid-1970s, and in his memoirs, he repeated the same story. And this was a domino theory story. He said that an Italian businessman had come to him after Allende was elected and said, "You know, Mr. President, you have communist Cuba in the Caribbean, and now you have the election of a avowed socialist on the mainland of Latin America. You have a red sandwich, and pretty soon it will all be red. You had the two sides, and it was all gonna come together." This was the kind of domino theory idea that Nixon said publicly. Finally, November of 2000, we have a document that was withheld from us for all these years. It was a document created in November, 2 days after Allende's inauguration, where all of these initial covert operations to thwart his actually becoming president had failed. And now Nixon was sitting down with his entire cabinet, and finally, after all these years, we have the minutes, the actual transcript of the cabinet meeting with Nixon and Spiro Agnew and Secretary of State Rogers and Secretary of Defense Melvin Laird. You know, we've forgotten about these guys, haven't we? But most of us can remember them here. Richard Helms and Henry Kissinger. And they're all sitting around together in the cabinet room, and they are talking about, and I quote from the document, "doing it right and bringing him down. We can bring his downfall," as Secretary Rogers put it. "We have to do everything we can to hurt him and bring him down," as the Secretary of Defense Melvin Laird put it. And here was Nixon convening his entire cabinet to say, okay, Allende's been inaugurated, but now we have to do whatever we can across the board in all of our agencies to undermine him and bring him down. And Nixon told his cabinet for the first time, the only time we have his actual words of what was bothering him about Allende's election. "Our main concern in Chile," he says, "is the prospect that Allende can consolidate himself and the picture projected to the world will be his success." In other words, that he would be democratically elected socialist, that he would be able to reform Chile's economic institutions significantly through the electoral process, and that other countries would see this as a model of success. Not that he would take over, create a communist dictatorship, and kind of militarily or forcefully repress the people and export revolution, but that he would be seen as a model of success. And then he goes on to say that if there is any way we can hurt him, by government or private business, I want them to know our policy is negative. He said, "No impression should be permitted in Latin America that they can get away with this," i.e. electing a leftist president, "that it's safe to go this way," Nixon says. And then for those of you who remember his famous speech in the 50s about not having him to be kicked around anymore when he claimed he was going to retire from politics, which he then didn't, he states, "All over the world, it's too much the fashion to kick us around. We cannot fail to show our displeasure." And that was the true reasons why Richard Nixon undertook these policies and ordered Allende to be undermined and overthrown. The documents allow us to be in the room as these things are being discussed and stated. We now have dozens of transcripts of Henry Kissinger's meetings, not only with his own staff, but with Chilean officials as well. And those allow us to begin rewriting history. Henry Kissinger, a very, very intelligent fellow, and he wrote three very comprehensive volumes of memoirs. And slowly but surely, my organization, the National Security Archive, has been obtaining the documents that he used for those three volumes of memoirs. Now, what Kissinger did is he took all of his documents with him when he left the government. And he put them into a secret trust in the Library of Congress, where they were organized by a staff that he employed. They were off limits to everybody else until 5 years after his death. Among these documents were what are called telcons, and that is the transcripts of his many telephone conversations, which he recorded. We have an interesting dynamic now in that Richard Nixon, of course, recorded his telephone conversations, too, with a taping device in his office. Kissinger had a secretary turn on a kind of a recording machine on an outside phone outside of his office and then type up a transcript after every phone call of what was said. And now, when, of course, Nixon and Kissinger talk to each other, we now have two sets of recorded transcripts, and in the case of Nixon himself, we actually have the tapes. But slowly but surely, we've been getting documents declassified. One of the ones we got declassified, my organization, recently was a document which was a transcript of a conversation between President Gerald Ford, Henry Kissinger, and the dictator in Indonesia about the invasion that was about to happen of East Timor. I don't know how many of you saw this big spread on this document in the New York Times, but Kissinger in his memoirs had written that they barely discussed East Timor. And this document showed that, in fact, the majority of the meeting was about East Timor, and the president of Indonesia has basically said to Kissinger and Ford, "We're going to invade East Timor tomorrow. We want to make sure that you're okay with this." And Kissinger responded, Well, it would be better if you waited until we got back to Washington so we could handle the fallout of all this, because certainly we're going to be accused of giving you weapons that were supposed to be just for defensive purposes and not for offensive purposes. But we will handle this. If you just let us get back to Washington, we will take care of this. It was basically a document that showed that Kissinger and Ford knew in advance about the pending invasion and gave their approval for it. It's known as the Green Light Document. Kissinger was forced to kind of basically apologize to the New York Times reporter and say that, yes, his memoirs were not accurate, because, of course, the history was classified at the time that he wrote it. Now it's been declassified. We've been able to do this with the Chilean case as well. In his last set of memoirs, which are about his years in the Ford administration as Secretary of State, Kissinger wrote about a meeting that he had with Augusto Pinochet in June of 1976. This was at the height of Pinochet's repression. Almost 3,000 people at that point had been killed, tortured to death, or disappeared. And Kissinger had briefing papers telling him about all of these atrocities. He went to give a speech, ironically, on human rights at the OAS conference in Santiago. Because part of what had happened was that Congress and the American public were very upset about the Ford and Kissinger policy of supporting Pinochet, irregardless of his human rights atrocities. And human rights legislation was being passed in Washington that was basically curtailing the latitude of policymakers like Kissinger to support the Pinochets of the world. And so his staff said to him, if you give a strong speech on human rights in Chile and you bring some pressure on the Chileans, you'll be able to mollify Congress. So Kissinger agreed to go to Chile and give this speech. But before he gave the speech, he went and had a private meeting with Augusto Pinochet. And in his memoir, he wrote that a considerable amount of time in my dialogue, I'm quoting from his memoir, a considerable amount of time in my dialogue with Pinochet was devoted to human rights, which were in fact the principal obstacle to close United States relations with Chile. I outlined my main points, the main points of my speech, the OAS, which I would deliver the next day. Pinochet made no comment. That's what's in his memoirs. One of the documents that was declassified is the actual transcript of his meeting with Augusto Pinochet, which I will pass around so people can take a look at it. Let me just tell you what the section where Kissinger talks to Pinochet about the fact that he's going to give this speech the next day at the OAS. This is what he actually said. In contrast to what he says in his memoir, this is the MemCon, the Memorandum of Conversation. Kissinger says, I will treat human rights in general terms and human rights in a world context. I will refer in two paragraphs to the report on Chile that was published by the OAS Human Rights Commission. I will say that the human rights issue has impaired relations between the United States and Chile. This is partly the result of congressional actions. I will add that I hope you will shortly remove those obstacles. Then this is the important part. I can do no less, he told Pinochet, without producing a reaction in the United States which would lead to legislative restrictions. The speech is not aimed at Chile. I wanted to tell you about this. My evaluation is that you are a victim of all left-wing groups around the world, and that your greatest sin was that you overthrew a government that was going communist.
You're listening to Peter Kornbluh, The Other September 11th, Chile, 1973. This is Independent Alternative Radio. To get copies of this program, call us at 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or go online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. www.kissingerarchives.org.
That's what Kissinger actually said to Pinochet. Yes, he said, I'm going to give this speech tomorrow.